Blog Talk Radio.
Good to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about what's happening in the world today. We talk about where the world is going, and we talk about the future. And we're not afraid to take a pretty unusual view of those matters, to wit, we believe that the world might just be getting better all the time. We believe that there's a pretty good case to be made that the world might be getting better all the time. And then if you're not paying attention to the future, if you're not excited about the future, you're just not paying attention. Excuse me, I have a little computer difficulty here. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you, man?
I'm good. I just almost crashed there for a moment, and I was afraid that that the audio had gone away, so I wasn't sure if anyone was still hearing me. So I thought if I muffed my lines bad enough, you would jump
in. I would laugh or something to let you know that you're still broadcasting. Huh?
Yeah, some kind of nervous cough or something like that. Regular listeners know what we're about. We're all about the future. We're all about something's going to happen, something wonderful. That's what I meant to say. So. We got a fun show tonight. We're doing a follow up to the program we did on Thursday, which was at on a special evening. We were able to accommodate a special guest, Joseph Jackson, who is starting a journal dedicated to the subject of post scarcity. The new journal called Abundance, dealing with this issue of a world without scarcity. And we spent a full 90 minutes, or was it 75 minutes? We did.
It was more than an hour, but I don't think we got quite to 90 minutes. It was probably about 70 minutes. Yeah.
About a 70-minute show, so and barely scratched the surface. And with Joseph having much, it felt like we could hardly get a word in edgewise in order to allow him to lay out his case. So we thought, well, what the heck? Tonight we don't have any official formal guests lined up, so we'll take some time to kind of reflect, debrief, and give our own thoughts on what a world without scarcity might be like.
Yeah, this guy, Joseph is an absolute, expert in the field of post-scarcity, and I frankly didn't want to interrupt him, while he was laying out what he felt post-scarcity was all about. But upon reflection, in the time since Thursday night, I've realized, hey, I've got some ideas I'd like to share, and I think Phil's the same way about that.
Yeah, well, always, we've always got plenty to say. It's just the way it works around here. And speaking of people who always have plenty to say, our chat host, Michael Darling, I believe, is on the line with us also.
I'm here.
Hey, Michael, I want to thank you for providing so much blog fodder over the weekend. I don't know if you've noticed that there was a post attributed to you, and then you were quoted in a completely different post on The Speculist. So you're like this, source material for posts. And then Will Brown did a follow-up post to something I wrote, and he quoted you. So
I'm here to help.
you've provided tremendous material, and I mean, we weren't making fun of your typing or anything either. I mean, we were actually dealing with your ideas. So, thank you very much for the content.
Well, I got nothing.
for that reason, in addition to managing the chat this evening, we hope you'll also participate in our discussion of post scarcity. Time permitting, of course.
I hope so, too.
Oh, okay. There it is. All right. Well, I think maybe we should just leap right into it, Stephen. Did we have any opening things we needed to talk about this evening before we jump into the topic?
No. I don't suppose any of y'all have taken the kids to Coraline yet or not, huh? I hear it's good. I have not seen it, and it's all the rage right now as far as those who with kids. So I guess I should be ready with a movie review next week or something.
Yeah,
both,
come back and tell us in.
Both my boys saw the preview with me. I forget what we were seeing, but we saw something when that was in preview land. I think we went to see I'm not going to remember what we saw because it was so forgettable, but we saw it as a preview. Both of them were kind of creeped out by the overall look and didn't want to see it.
Yeah. Well, word is that it may be the first 3D movie to win an Oscar. You know, so it's supposed to be really good. So, anyway, I'm sure I'll be...
I didn't catch the title. What's it called?
Coraline. Coraline.
You know, I don't know anything at all about this movie. I'm gonna have to get caught up. First 3D movie ever to win an Oscar, perhaps.
Perhaps, yeah. They're saying it's really good for. It's a kids movie, of course, but it's stop motion animated. Plus, it's 3D. So I mean, you know, it's a little bit different from your typical fare. So I gotta see it and get back with the audience and give a review next week.
Very interesting. Let us know. Speaking of 3D, I'll throw this out here. A little bit of accelerating technological change that I've encountered in the day job. Do you know there is a display technology available now where you can show video in 3D and there's no glasses required? Have you heard of this?
Yes, I have. It's still priced out of the range of your average person, right?
It is. I will be actually taking advantage of that technology for some special events I'm doing at a trade show coming up in a couple of weeks where we're announcing a new product. And we're going to have it up on a 60-inch 3D monitor. And you don't need glasses, and apparently the whole thing's going to be in 3D, so I'm really psyched about that. So that'll be something I get to report back on here in a couple of weeks is 3D, no glasses required display. We'll see if it lives up to the hype. But,
well, I'll be glad when that becomes the standard for 3D because I can't enjoy 3D being a person who wears glasses, and then I have to go in and you know try to figure out some way to finagle the 3D glasses around the glasses I normally wear. It just doesn't work. It ends up not working for me. So
I always think it's too much trouble. I mean, it's cool when Superman Returns came out in 3D. My daughter and my wife took me to see it on 3D IMAX, and it's very cool, but it's always a little out of focus or a little weird, or it makes you a little nauseous or something. I don't know what it is, but there's just something unsettling about the whole thing, such that it's as distracting as it is impressive because of the glasses and the whole, like, weird focus thing. So I'm hoping to see if this display technology takes care of that issue. Then, yeah, eventually we should hope that, one day everything will be in 3D, so that's an exciting thing to look forward to, I think.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, let's jump into our discussion of the end of scarcity. And I want to start off by referring to a piece that was in Seed magazine, and it was written by a guy named Bruno Argento. And Bruno Argento is actually an alter ego of Bruce Sterling. It's an interesting thing he does. He has a fictional identical twin brother who's Italian, thus the name Bruno Argento. I'm guessing Argento is probably Italian for silver or sterling or something like that. So, and Bruno, get it? So he writes these like point counterpoint essays with himself, okay? And he wrote this piece in Seed, and it was all about it's all over. I mean, it was really depressing. It was really, point by point why the world is going to hell in a handbasket. And Bruno comes back, and he writes this somewhat more optimistic, more cautiously optimistic piece. And we'll include a link to this in the show notes. But I think
let me interrupt you just real quick, Phil. I believe Will Brown has joined us. Will, is that you?
Yeah, it is, Stephen. How are you?
Oh, very good, very good.
Hey, Will, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Oh, well, Phil, how things are?
I'm super fantastic. Well, you know, it's starting to snow, but we're not going to experience any scarcity of winter weather for the foreseeable future, global warming notwithstanding. Glad you're able to join us. We had actually extended an invitation to you and to one other regular listener who had posted some interesting comments, and glad you're able to join us. Well, we're just...
We still there?
Yeah, I wonder if we've lost Phil. Are you there, Phil?
I'm here, but I just got the English lady just told me I'm now in the host queue. Or did anyone else hear that?
I did not hear that, but I hear you fine now. So go ahead.
Bizarre.
There's our glitch for the evening, hopefully.
You're coming out in stereo, Phil.
Okay, that's what I like to hear. Okay, so I'm gonna read a little section from Bruno Argento's Moderately More Optimistic, because I think he introduces a very interesting concept here. And the concept is the useful word, as he says. We now come to the useful word precarity, which is part of the American lifestyle but distant from American politics. Precarity is, of course, the condition of existing precariously, the condition of losing one's safety and security, of losing predictability and the ability to rationally plan ahead, the condition of being humiliated and in danger. Precarity has much to do – oh, and Stephen and I were talking about this before the program. I think Bruce Sterling made this word up. I believe the word is precariousness. So just throwing that out there. I don't think there's such a word as precarity. But we'll use it because, it's a cool new word and it's shorter. So.
And Bruce Sterling's a great writer, so, yeah, we're going to go with it.
He likes coming up with, he came up with Slipstream. He came up with Bucky Junk. He's actually kind of known for coming up with new words. So precarity is another, I think he's trying here. So we'll go with it. All right, precarity has much to do with the need for a steady income, for predictable hours of work, for a humane respect for one's employer, and a need not to be unjustly fired. Below this thin shell of labor management relations is the deeper, more primal nature of European precarity. It is found in our time-honored European predilection for abject misery, political extremism, totalitarian violence against the dignity of the individual, and world wars. So he's a little hard on Europe there. Normally, Americans and Europeans fail to agree about precarity. Americans think their precarity is a kind of fluidity and dynamism, while Europeans are lazy feather bedders dawdling over two-hour lunches. But what's certain is that whatever its definition, precarity is now global. The wealthy and powerful, especially the wealthy and powerful, are precarious. They are being flung about like flotsam, and the precarity once reserved for blue-collar workers is now inside the corner office and the corporate boardroom as well. This means that we all have new chances to see eye to eye on major global economic issues such as currency flows and the aging population. And he gives an interesting example. Italy is leading the way in aging. We're the oldest country in Europe. I did not know that. I think that's interesting. And business stabilized remarkably when we rid ourselves of the comically useless Italian lira. It's proof that people can both adapt to the inevitable and make some bold steps. So this is Bruce Sterling writing Bruno Argento laying out the idea of precarity, and he ends on this this idea of adapting to the inevitable and making some bold steps, which I think relates very closely to what we're talking about here. And I think the idea of there being precariousness, there being risk in the world, is kind of one of the fundamental issues that you have to work through if you're going to figure out how you could get to a world of abundance, how you could get to a world that is post-scarcity. So I would start with this question, and I'll throw it out to any of the three on the line here who would like to take a stab at it. And the question is, do free markets assume that life must be precarious?
Well, I'm going to jump in here and say that free markets require that life be precarious to a certain degree in order to be free.
Okay.
Otherwise, they're some version of overly regulated transaction. How's that compared to precarity?
I think that's a very straightforward answer. Stephen, would you agree with that?
Well, I'm not sure that I agree, Will. And let me. I think that free markets depend on one thing, and that's scarcity. If we all have, let's say that we all are very comfortable in our positions. None of us are precarious in our lives. We know that we're going to have a certain amount of money coming in every month, and that's just the way it is. We're precarity is long gone. If provided that there are still scarce goods to that our dollars could chase after, then you still got a free market. Do you not?
Well, no, because that's an aspect of a market, whether it's regulated or free, and a free market doesn't really exist. It's a theoretical construct. But a less regulated market, a free market, is requiring local scarcity, not genuine absolute scarcity. If you have absolute scarcity, you've got nothing to market in. So you have to have local scarcity in which, you know, to create a market transaction possibility. So, scarcity is always a localized thing. Otherwise, you don't have anything to market to have them get in. So scarcity is always a localized event to some degree.
Well, I think the point's making there, Will, that the scarcity is localized to the folks who have demand. But unless someone has supply, right, unless there's a lack of scarcity elsewhere, you wouldn't have any market transactions occurring at all. So I think that's a good point. So, Stephen, I would throw that back to you.
The other thing is I did want to bring up one other thing that Stephen mentioned. And a lot of this precarity on it is, I think, has a lot to do with just how, you know, perspective. We're able to, because of, you know, the internet and shows like this and various other communication facts, we're able to be more aware of other people's condition than we were in the past, and, you know, in human historical past. So there's a lot of heightened awareness that people aren't quite as secure as, you know, was always assumed just from their, you know, their public appearance. So the idea that, you know, even the rich or, you know, the influential are in a more precarious position, I don't think that's really necessarily true. It's just that we're more aware of it than was maybe the case in the past. How do you think of that?
I think there's something to be said for that. I think that you're probably jumping ahead of my questions, actually.
Okay. Stephen brought it up first.
I'm gonna work through them in order anyway. But I was gonna say, Stephen, that the interesting thing is if you go back to your original definition, based on Will's answer, it sounds like a free market depends on scarcity, but also depends on abundance. Right? It's the tension between those two things that makes that makes a free market possible. It sounds like you have to have both in order for a free market to exist.
Right. Right. If I show up at the gas station with a full tank, I'm not going to buy gas. I have to have scarcity in my gas tank, and they also have to have abundance in their of gas down in their tanks in the ground. So, or they're not going to have anything to sell to me. So yeah, that seems pretty straightforward. Yes.
Okay. Next question was, so we talked about free markets. Now let's talk about socialist setups, socialist programs, government sponsored programs. Do those kinds of programs eliminate precarity?
Socialism.
Socialist programs, government programs.
Well, short term, yes. Long term, no.
I think I'd differ with you on that slightly, Stephen.
Okay.
Socialism would tend to obscure it rather than relieve it and then reinforce the conditions it causes precariousness, I would think. That's my understanding and my experience of socialism then.
I'd agree with that. I don't disagree with that at all.
Yeah, I certainly think while they're running, you know, I was in Russia in the early to mid-90s. And it's like once they're gone, right, you got precariousness like you never had before. You know, you've got a level of just absolute arbitrariness to how the world works in a state that was completely planned, an economy that was completely planned. And now at that point anyway, where it felt like there was no planning at all, not only is there the fact that suddenly everything's unexpected, everything's unanticipated, so you've got all this precariousness. You've also got this, nobody was ever expecting it, right? You didn't have any precarity muscles built up as a player in the Soviet economy.
Nobody there had any experience of it.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So it's like, I think that while they're running, I think they reduce precariousness. I mean, not to say they give you everything you need in the world, but that's one thing they definitely cut down on is how precarious the economy is. But, man, once they're gone, life gets a lot more precarious. At least that's been my observation.
Phil, I was on Instapundit about an hour or so ago, and Glenn Reynolds had posted an old video of Milton Friedman talking with Phil Donahue. And I liked it so well, I grabbed an MP3 of the audio, the play. And so basically what I'm trying to say is Milton Friedman has an opinion on these issues, and I'd like to play it for everybody and see what y'all think.
Okay, before we do that, let's just say this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking about a world without scarcity, and we're going to hear what Milton Friedman told Phil Donahue about it. Let's go.
Okay, the first voice you hear is Phil Donahue.
When you see around the globe the maldistribution of wealth, the desperate plight of millions of people in underdeveloped countries, when you see so few haves and so many have-nots, when you see the greed and the concentration of power within, did you ever have a moment of doubt about capitalism and whether greed's a good idea to run on?
Well, first of all, tell me, is there some society you know that doesn't run on greed? You think Russia doesn't run on greed? You think China doesn't run on greed? What is greed? Of course, none of us are greedy. It's only the other fellow who's greedy. The world runs on individuals pursuing their separate interests. The great achievements of civilization have not come from government bureaus. Einstein didn't construct his theory under order from a bureaucrat. Henry Ford didn't revolutionize the automobile industry that way. In the only cases in which the masses have escaped from the kind of grinding poverty you're talking about, the only cases in recorded history are where they have had capitalism and largely free trade. If you want to know where the masses are worst off, it's exactly in the kinds of societies that depart from that. So that the record of history is absolutely crystal clear. That there is no alternative way so far discovered of improving the lot of the ordinary people that can hold a candle to the productive activities that are unleashed by a free enterprise system.
But it seems to reward not virtue as much as ability to manipulate the system.
And what does reward virtue? You think the communist commissar rewards virtue? You think a Hitler rewards virtue?
Okay. Well, I thought it was pretty much on point, so I thought I'd throw that out there.
Okay, well, that's great stuff. I love the references about greed and rewarding virtue. I know that Friedman was asking those not intending to get an answer. I wonder if Donahue was able to put an answer together on that. I thought that was. Interesting stuff. So,
our guest on Thursday night said almost something very, very similar, basically saying that, you know, so many of our jobs are non-productive, because the market economy is not in so many words, he was saying basically that the market economy is not rewarding the virtue of productivity sufficiently enough. We're all doing, you know, BS jobs and that don't amount to anything. And I disagreed with our guest on that point. I believe that the market, you know, maybe my particular job doesn't make a widget or result in the in a mile of highway necessarily directly. But if what I did was useless, then I would not be able to earn a living doing it. So
right. Anyway. Well, I think. I think there's something to be said for that argument. I think that, to be fair, that Joseph wasn't arguing in favor of something like, the communist system. He was talking about something else to come down the road later. And
yeah.
whether it's productive in the sense of, contributing to the overall economy versus productive in the sense of actually producing the stuff we need to get by. Now that becomes a pretty interesting question, because certainly, if I look at the work I do for a software company, we are clearly several steps removed from the productive work. Ultimately, you know, there's going to be some company that uses the software that the company that I works for, that I work for, they'll use that software, and some customer of theirs is the person who, you know, Thursday night digs up the turnips, right?
Phil, I would just say only if your definition of productive is particularly narrow. I say, build, you know, if your company is making software, and you are involved in helping even to market that software, then that's productive work.
Stephen, I think you've got to go with that narrow definition. We're talking about a world without material scarcity.
I see.
So,
okay.
So, for purposes of that, I'll
go along with the narrow definitions if that's the reason why we're doing it. But our jobs may be not. You know, I don't have to farm for a living anymore, but that doesn't mean I'm not productive, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Granted. You are productive, but I think the productivity we're talking about is the actual the production of material stuff, right?
Yeah.
Because let me jump down to the next question, which is, can we achieve sufficient material abundance that precarity is removed from survival and shifted to other areas? See, that's what happens in the economy of the I get to be first answering this one. I asked it.
Sorry, Will.
It's all right.
Everybody gets a turn to be first, including the guy asking the question. In the economy we're in now, which is one in which I think, to Joseph's point, very few people are actually in the material production of stuff. The precarity has been removed from survival and shifted to other areas. And Stephen, you and I were talking about this before the program.
Yeah.
Precarity for us in this generation means something very different from the kind of precariousness, the kind of risk that was faced by people a few generations ago, and certainly from people a few dozen or a few hundred generations ago. We don't really have, by and large, material. I'm going to start that sentence over. I think in the United States today, we pretty much have achieved subsistence for everyone, by and large. I'm not saying that some people don't slip through the cracks, but there is virtually no people starving in this country, right? Anyone who wants to have the minimal, like, shelter over their head for the night, in most places you can get that somewhere. You know, it's not great, but
it takes a crisis like Katrina or here lately the freezing storm in Kentucky to create a short-term situation in this country, basically, where a significant number of people are in trouble materially. And yeah, so that's I agree completely. I believe we've crossed a milestone at some point, probably in the 20th century, where we no longer are. It's life and limb is usually not the thing that's on the line when we're talking about our precarity.
Yeah, when you see people facing not having a place to sleep at night, I mean, groups of people, they don't have power in their homes, or they don't, they're at risk from death from exposure, as I guess some of the folks in Kentucky have been up against with the freezing. That's like an exception. It becomes news because the norm now is that all those material needs are met. And we did that, I think, completely unintentionally in this case. Not completely, but there was no government program stated to eliminate scarcity that actually led to this. There might have been government programs that said they would eliminate scarcity, but they're not what really led to the situation that we have today. It seems to me that from your earlier points, it was probably economic development on the one hand and just this kind of social conscience on the other, which put us in this place where, in a sort of ad hoc way, because it's a bunch of different things going together. The other piece I would add is that nobody gets kicked out of the emergency room, right? So
right.
If you're sick, you can get medical attention. If you're hungry, there are people giving away food almost everywhere. I mean, it's possible somebody starves to death. And if you have no shelter or clothing, there are people who will give you those things, right? It's like those bare material subsistence survival things are actually provided in this country. Now, they might be provided in a way that is too precarious for some to, you know, some might say, no, it should be done not that way, but this way. But I would argue that we already live in a post-scarcity society, at least where basic physical survival is concerned. Will, what do you think?
Well, I would differ with you on the word provided, for one. I think it's widely available if you want to obtain it, whatever, you know, the particular item happens to be. If it's a place to sleep or, you know, a five-star meal, it's available. It's widely available to a degree that's never been achieved in human history prior to this, essentially, over the last centuries, say. I would agree with that, but it's not provided, and I don't think the future is going to provide it either, unless you're talking robotic plays, and I think we've been down that court in the past. I don't think that's the case. So the fact that there's going to be heightened expectations in the future, and that our expectations of what's normal now are higher than our grandparents were and theirs were before their grandparents. You go back far enough from grandparents, and eventually it flattens out. The expectation curve does. And, the beauty of exponential growth, of course, the farther up you go, the faster it gets, the higher expectations rise. So, at some point we're going to reach an abundance, an effective material abundance, allowing for, local temporary scarcities, so that there will be some market transactions that would so far exceed our current expectations as to make it seem nirvana, but I don't think the people at the time will be any more overwhelmed by it all than we are today. That it's going to be a matter of, again, a perspective. It's just normal, because even if it's an exponential curve, you go up with it and your expectations go along. So my point would be that I don't think abundance ever exceeds demand. So we're never going to have
we can always expect more, even in the most abundant society, can't we?
Oh yeah.
Our expectations can grow. I agree. Phil and I have had a very similar conversation. And even in the most abundant civilization I can imagine, where literally every material good that's imaginable is available to every person at any time they're ready for it, there would still be some things that would remain scarce.
Well, one of the things that, kind of moving us on to the whole singularity idea of abundance in the future is, what are we going to exchange when we can literally have everything? We can go into our closet and poop out whatever we want. We're still going to be exchanging our imaginations and our individual insights. There's still going to be something to exchange, whether it's physical or intellectual or emotional or what have you.
Right. I agree completely. And the things that remain scarce, like maybe a choice piece of real estate, leadership positions.
Sure.
I don't know.
Who's first in line?
Yeah, who's first in line?
A driver and a regulator of change, just generally speaking, and change towards achieving a singularity or just future growth in general. That's what I think. Scarcity is a necessity to achieving this.
Okay, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking about Future of Abundance, A World Without Scarcity. And if you're listening live, you can join us in our chat room or leave comments at blog.speculus.com. All right, well, I think that's true. I think that when we talk scarcity, we've got to be talking about material scarcity, because I don't think anyone is suggesting that we would ever have a world without some notion of it. And most of the models that you see, they talk about eventually we would have a currency that is based on reputation or overall contribution. Stephen, to go back to our earlier discussion, all the other kinds of productivity other than the actual production of material goods. So I think that you can have scarcity. You can have competition. In fact, we got a great comment from Alvis in the chat room. Humans are designed for competition. We ascend the hierarchy of need, but we don't care diversify, right? So we got a new word now, deprecarification. And I think Alvis is exactly right that the precariousness will be there. It just will, per your point, it won't be about whether you have something to eat, and it won't be about even whether you have a pretty nice place to live or have a car or unlimited internet access. It will be about something farther down the value chain than we are currently. I'm getting now maybe that the word deprecarify actually came from Michael, not from Alvis. I'm not sure. I can't see the chat room, so I just want to give credit to whoever came up with that excellent word. Thank you for that. Now,
sounds like
that could. I'll tell you what, those guys tell you the truth, so that could go either way. Let's talk about. I've set up four models for how this could happen, and what I'd like to do. With your permission, gentlemen, is let's talk through each one of them and talk about what after I get through the four, if you guys have another one, we can throw that in. In fact, why don't I read through the four and you guys can tell me if you think that's a fairly good list. Here are my four scenarios for how we get to a world without scarcity, okay?
Okay.
Right. And they are, number one, pure technology, which would be replicators and robots producing abundance for all with limited or no government involvement. Number two would be a pure government approach, which would mean social engineering and economic restructuring to eliminate scarcity without reliance on any further technological breakthroughs. I think everyone would have to agree that the technological breakthroughs we've had up to this point would be important, but none further required, that we could get started on it right away, in other words. And I think that would be my restatement of what Joseph was saying Thursday evening.
Right.
Or Wednesday.
I agree. That's what he was saying.
Okay. Number three would be a government/technology hybrid, which would be various kinds of partnership between a pure technology approach and a government approach. And number four would be an economic singularity, which is where the robots take over. Okay, you have an AI or post-human intelligence that is going to take the matter out of our hands and provide us with a world of limitless abundance. So first, I'll say, guys, are you comfortable with that list, or do we need to add any items to it?
The pure technology. I don't think any of these actually covers all of it, but okay, we'll go with what you got for now. I'm not going to finish it. Let's go.
I've got nothing to add.
Okay. All right. Well, by coming up with number three, I felt like it covered. You know, we covered most of the possibilities. But you know, if something else occurs to you,
there might be various hybrids other than government technology. But yeah, I think we. That's pretty good.
Okay.
I do have one question about pure technology.
Okay.
Is it more on an individual level or a industrial level?
Good question.
This would. You know what? I think for it to work. As the alternative to government, it would almost have to be on the individual level, wouldn't it? If it happens on the industrial level, then you still need some kind of distribution mechanism. So you get into at least the hybrid model, if not the government model. Okay, so yeah, I'm thinking about individual replicators or individuals owning robots or individuals owning the means of production for themselves.
Yeah, I have a little factory basically sitting right next to my computer in my house that can produce anything I want it to, basically, is what we're talking about.
I got a fifth one.
Michael's got a fifth one. Go.
Actually, it's okay, David Ray in the chat proposes number five. At first look, I thought, oh, this is pure technology, number one, but it's not. It's technologically driven, but he says, we live in a virtual world and physical scarcity just doesn't matter.
Wow.
So he's talking
okay.
Post-uplink or
something.
Yeah, so
Post, either transhumanist, post-uplink, although he specifically says not transhumanist, but virtual reality where we choose to focus on what's going on, you know, in our virtual reality and not, you know, physical. So we transcend scarcity.
I love that one, and I'm going to say that that is a subset of pure technology. That is a means, that is a technological means of getting there.
It didn't eliminate physical scarcity. It just transcended it.
Yeah.
It made it irrelevant.
Not quite sure how that works. there's got to be some hamsters turning the wheels, keeping the power going for those machines we're living inside, right? I mean,
that's where the robots come in.
Phil, my vote is that it's a number five. I like it well enough. It ought to have its own number, if that's okay.
Right, well, I love virtual worlds. Hey, nobody likes them more than I do. Okay, so.
Never was that big a fan of the later Star Trek versions. I don't like the holodeck, sorry.
It's the last invention anyone needs to make.
Well, and now it's number five on our list, so it's the last item on our list. Okay, so let's start with the pure technology, not counting virtual worlds idea, and let me just throw it out here. What would the advantages to that approach be?
Let's give that to Will first, our guest.
Oh, thanks. Well, let's see.
Unless you want to pass, Will, I'm not putting you on the spot.
Obviously, the freedom of initiative on your part. It's presuming we're using the Drexler model of the nano factory and makes everything out of dirt and you toss it back in when you're done and reuse it. I'm not quite sure how you make the technology that makes that doesn't make you, but, trying cloning there. There's some real ethical difficulties with just the technology itself. I'm not at all sure how we get from where we are to that model.
Okay, but that's
it's a wonderful objective, but I'm not sure how we do it.
I would classify that one under drawbacks, actually, which is a letter. And by the way, the cloning thing, let me just point out, would help us to eliminate like scarcity of ourselves, right? So you could have an abundance of willed brains.
I like me well enough as it is, but I don't want to look over my shoulder and see me. It's boring. It's something else. I have two ex-wives who probably have a different word for it.
you never know what those other wills are going to be up to. Okay, so advantages. To summarize, advantages would be the kind of self-directed nature of it, and that we would get to own our own destiny, in addition to being free at last from material want. Okay, that's my paraphrase of what you said. Now, drawbacks. Stephen, what do you think?
Drawbacks of the pure technology approach to getting us to post-scarcity?
Yes.
Well, none that I – there are no drawbacks to which I subscribe, but I could slip into Phil Donahue's shoes and say, well, it's just – there's so many haves and so many have – so few haves and so many have-nots how are we going to address that without a government approach? So that would be a drawback from the point of view of somebody else. I favor the pure technology approach myself.
Well, I like the sound of it best of all four, except maybe for the economic singularity, which could be way fun. But actually, virtual worlds could be way fun too. This is a pretty good list. It's mostly good. I would add as a drawback that it does threaten the status quo in a huge way. So you find yourself up against vested economic interests, and Joseph was talking about this the other night, downloading music threatened the music business, the way we've talked about replicators might at some point threaten Walmart, and the way people being able to completely take care of their own lives and run their own lives would be a huge threat to government. So from an implementation standpoint, I think drawbacks are of this one, or potential drawbacks would be just that you have to take on, it's a real David versus Goliath thing to get to this world, because there would be a lot of forces who would see this as upsetting their apple cart, would not go.
Well, any of these things would be a complete revolution, Phil, and with a revolution comes people that are unhappy about it. So,
entrenched interests to any change in anything. There's always an entrenched interest that's going to oppose it, whether it's a change in the postal rates, whatever.
Yeah.
And something as fundamental and dramatic as this, everybody, the churches, you've already mentioned politicians, businesses, you can't come up with anybody who won't oppose it for you on some basis.
Right.
But that's basically true of almost any change to some degree. So there's nothing.
Yeah,
really
almost
that
any change will be opposed. Almost any change will be opposed by somebody. This one gets opposed. I think points well taken by almost everybody. That's the problem. And if you compare. Likelihood.
Well, you know, the thing about it, Phil, is that I might, you know, let's say I've got some vested interest that I'm unhappy that it's being eroded by this. I would want everyone else to stop using the technology, but I'm sure as heck
not
going to get rid of my my nano factory sitting right here next to me. Shoot, I'm not giving that up. You know.
Yeah, I'm not saying that the drawbacks mean it won't happen. I'm just saying that those are the drawbacks, right?
Those are definitely drawbacks. Yes, we're agreed there.
To throw them out. So, what do we see as the likelihood of the pure technology scenario?
Well, wait, Michael had a drawback that he wanted to bring up.
Go, Michael.
It's hard to secure unless the technology itself is either not physical, it's knowledge based. Or it's self-securing or autonomously secure. It's just I think it adds a layer of precariousness. It separates us from whatever keeps us alive now and makes us dependent on that. And that in and of itself adds a layer of precariousness. Unless, like I said, it's either knowledge-based, so it's not a thing. It's a how, not a what. Or it's, you know, inherently self-securing.
I don't think that necessarily is true, Michael, because that doesn't really change anything. You've got a TV and you've got other items of some value in your home. Is that one more item of value really going to change your precariousness that much?
To the degree.
Particularly when it's one that everybody else has access to.
Right, but to the degree that my life or my lifestyle, if you want to get, you know, 80s on it, is dependent on the technology that I've brought into my house. To the degree that that goes away, and I'm dependent on it, I've got to have a refrigerator. I've got to have internet. I've got to have a phone. I've got to have. Well, that's all, you know, at some level you go, well, yeah, but it's not going to go away. Yeah, but if the truck stopped coming to the Safeway in my neighborhood, I got a problem because I can't grow anything where I live.
And your neighbor comes through your front door and while you're gone and it all goes away, what's one more item of precariousness? I grant you it is a item over which you can become precarious, but it's not intrinsically different from items you already have, I don't think.
Actually, Michael, to take another interpretation of what you said, I think that the notion of an added level of risk is definitely there. I don't think you have a risk of not getting stuff. We're assuming a world where everybody's got a replicator and or a robot. I mean, the transition, okay, maybe, right? That most of your neighborhood has replicators.
During the transition, very precarious.
Yeah, extremely precarious. But once we're there, what's the risk? Well, the risk is, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, what if the cute kid in Africa decides to stop making things of value to her community with the replicator and decides to start seeing what kind of bombs she can churn out with the thing, right? Or what kind of lethal viruses she can churn out with the thing. So there is a decentralized advantage to the pure technology approach, and also a huge decentralized potential risk to the pure technology.
Absolutely.
I agree also.
Got the means of producing whatever. But we got four more of these, so we got to keep going.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to say likelihood on this one is about, I think it's very unlikely that we'll do a pure technology approach. I, much as I like it, I'm going to give it about a 20% chance.
Okay.
Fair.
Others? No? Anyone?
Well, I think it's the only route to the thing, so therefore I give it a much higher percentage chance. I believe that, you know, government's going to be involved in this and that, but I believe ultimately it will be the machine that gets us there in spite of other things, not because of other things.
Yeah, well, but in spite of could still be included in number three, which I – anyway, we're jumping.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. I'm splitting hairs. Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah. So, number two, pure government, social engineering and economic restructuring, eliminate scarcity without reliance on further technological breakthroughs. Stephen, this is challenging. Tell me the advantages to that approach.
To a pure government approach?
Yeah.
Advantage to a pure government approach, none of us has to worry. it's all being handled by Big Brother. I'm sorry, Phil. I can't be serious about the advantages to it because I don't believe in it.
Never has worked.
Yeah, but you're a lawyer. Just argue the pure government side.
Okay. I just did, but very facetiously.
No, I think there's another argument to be made, which is that the advantage to that approach would be that we've already got a really powerful central bureaucratic government that would just love to have its hands on this project. I'm not saying they could actually do it, but the advantage would be it would be much easier to implement, I think, than pure technology in terms of not having the whole world against you. I guess the advantage I'm saying is you wouldn't have the drawbacks of the government trying to shut it down if you were to try to get it. Don't think it would work, though. That's what I would consider the drawback. What do you think, Will, on that one?
Yeah, you've got the government bringing everyone down to the lowest common denominator and forcing everyone to stay there because you're not allowing new technology, if I understand this correctly.
Yeah.
So everybody crawling the obliette there and close the lid. Big Brother's sitting on top. I mean, I could make it work, but not very long.
It's the least post-scarce world you can get, right? It would be post-scarcity, but it's the least implementation of it you would have. Michael, any thoughts from yourself or anyone in the chat room on that one?
I'll say nobody else has commented on it yet, although I'm sure people like Steven are skeptical. I'm just reading between the lines on the chat. But I would say that if you want to force an advantage onto it, you'd say it's human and it's social, and to the degree that we don't have to wait for a wave of technology to be developed, it's just a way of thinking about things and organizing the way we interact. Okay, that's the plus, but it ain't ever going to happen.
That's the funny thing about this one is the advantage is you'd probably have an easier time getting the motion passed. Everyone could get on board for something like this. The downside is it just wouldn't work, right?
Well, to me, if the downside is it's just not going to work and we all agree that it's not going to work, then that just kills it. I mean, it's dead. I mean, there's no upside to it. That was my original point. But at any rate, I'm sorry.
You're absolutely right. And what is the likelihood? Anyone on this?
It's negative.
Yeah, I agree.
It's a negative probability.
Actually, I think somebody would probably try it, and they'll almost guaranteed fail. How's that? 1%?
I think the Eastern Bloc did try it throughout the 20th century, and it just didn't work out terribly well. So I'm gonna say
Venezuela right now.
Yeah.
Forget about the Eastern Bloc. Venezuela's trying to do it right now. It can't be done.
There you go. Yeah. Stay tuned. Venezuela might.
Good example. Good example, Michael.
Everybody, start holding your breath right now. Okay. Next one is the government/technology hybrid. I don't want this to become the Goldilocks just right approach, but this is the one that allows for a little of both. And if we live in a country right now that is post-scarcity, it actually is that, right? It's that productivity has taken us to a certain point where everybody has enough stuff. It's like there's these food banks, there's all these, you know, private means of providing goods. And then there are some things that are kind of handled by the government, and it's this odd little ad hoc part where one step fills the gap the other along the way. Stephen, I gave you the worst one before, so I'll give you this one now. What do you think would be the advantages of the hybrid approach?
Well, it's the advantage is that this is the way it will happen. I mean, we have a government that is sort of like, I don't know, the person at the party that you really wish wasn't there, but that you've got to entertain, and you have a good time in spite of them. You're going to have a government. You're going to have increased technology. The technology is going to deliver it in spite of the government being, their hands in the till, and that's what we're going to get. That's if it's going to happen, that's the way it will happen. So that's my two cents.
All right. Will, what do you think? Drawbacks?
Drawback. It's going to be the most likely to be adversarial in making achievements, but I also agree with Stephen. It's the most likely mechanism for getting from here to there.
Yeah. Stephen, I analogy of the guest at the gate, which wasn't there, but you had to have a good time. Is that original to you?
Yeah, I don't know, just came up. That just came to me.
That is beautiful. That's brilliant. Yeah, absolutely. That's putting. Well, here we are trying to have a post scarcity world, and look who shows up for crying out loud. Government.
Yeah.
That's it exactly. I think that at the bar, you won't get there efficiently as you would if you could do it more.
We're losing you. You're in and out, Phil, on your audio. I'm sorry. I'm having a lot of trouble hearing you.
Oh, is it any better?
Are you hearing him, Will?
He's breaking up.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I can hear him voices.
Okay. I'll try it again, Phil. I'm sorry. Okay, it sounds like he's going to call back in. Okay. All right. So,
it's just you and me. Since we seem to agree with everything, what kind of trouble can we get out of it?
That's right. We can go ahead and decide this debate right here and right now. But we do have one more thing to talk about, and that's the virtual reality method. So let's get Phil back in here. Phil.
Hey.
Okay, we got you back on. We can hear you good now.
Did you get before?
Once you complimented me on my brilliance, it got to where we couldn't hear you at all. So you better start from.
I was going to say I summed up the wisdom of the ages. I hope that it wasn't lost.
I'm afraid it was.
Oh, rats.
You were supposed to win lotto numbers.
Okay, so we all agree number three is the most likely, but it's a compromise. So we're not thrilled with it. Now number four, the economic singularity. Which is just a world of abundance following hard on the heels of a technological singularity. That's what I meant by this, and that is where the robots take the matter out of our hands, and they pretty much set us up on our own. What would be the advantages of that way of getting there, do you think, Will?
Advantages? We're not allowed to be disputatious with each other, presuming we give them that much authority over us. That's also a disadvantage, I think. We're giving them that much authority over us.
Yeah, it's kind of a two-edged sword, isn't it? It's like, well, the advantage is you figure the robots are going to be wicked efficient about this thing, and we won't have a lot of arguing. They'll set us straight. The disadvantage being, man, if we disagree with any part, they're in charge. All right, yeah.
Yeah, is it going to be... Are we going to get Utopia, or are we going to get Terminator? Is it Bill Joy or Kurzweil? One of them.
Right, or even, even if it's not Bill Joy, even if it's well-intentioned robots really trying to give us a world of abundance, but they just don't quite do it the way we'd like, They just do it in some kind of consistently irritating way,
I don't want to have Soylent Green again. I'm sorry. That's all I ever get to eat. I have it in abundance, but I'm tired of it.
Sick of that stuff. All right, Michael, anything from the chat room on the economic singularity?
No, but it provides an opportunity for me to bring up one thing I was going to bring up. Even before we got to list of four, it makes this one the most attractive and the most frustrating. And that's that economists and other social scientists have done all the hard work and the studies to show that in a situation where people get to make free economic choice, it's a totally free market, you can do whatever you want, people will do things that are economically disadvantageous to themselves in an effort to create the economic disadvantage for their neighbor. In other words, it's the disparity that we care about. Yes, I care that I have a nice car and a nice house and food, but what I really care about is that it's nicer than my neighbors in some way.
Very true.
And that disparity, that issue of disparity, defeats number one or number two, the pure government solution, because the pure government solution says if we wanted it, we could do it today. If it was just a social thing, we could do it. It isn't a social thing. We want that disparity. We thrive on that disparity, so it ain't going to be pure government. And in the what I prefer to think of as the robot overlord committee solution, it's a similar thing. If there's no disparity, it's going to drive us nuts. What's the point? And that's the part I can't see past, because I don't know how the economy functions, or even if we have what we would even call an economy in that era, when you get past that point.
Well, I think to the earlier conversation, to the earlier discussion we had on this, there will always be a disparity, because even if everyone has the exact same amount of stuff, and it's, you know, the playing field has been leveled to the 0.00001 millimeter, there's still the cool kids and the not cool kids, right? I mean, there's still going to be reputation, and there's still going to be means of establishing work that don't have to do with that don't have to do with goods.
Personal right. Perception and individual understanding. Right.
Right. So, okay, last one. The final one is the virtual worlds. So,
I'll take it as plan B. If pure technology, or, you know, some sort of a hybrid of technology and government doesn't work out, then and the robots don't deliver it, maybe it's plan C. Then we transcend it all.
I think it's the only way that plan 4 would work.
Well, I think
somebody's got to keep the hamster running in the wheel, like you pointed out. Somebody's got to keep, you know, all the stuff that's going to be handed out virtually, disposed of virtually. Somebody's got to keep track of all that and organize all that and stay running. And it ain't going to be the people being virtually gamed.
I think you're right there. That's why I would still put that one, I think, as a technological one. But I'm not sure that it's a plan B. It might be the end game. It could be that ultimately we end up in a completely virtual world, not because we couldn't afford to stay in the real one, but because finally we can have a much richer experience there than we can in the meat space universe. But that's somewhere past that technological singularity and well to that economic singularity before we would see that happen. Okay, well, we're running a little bit past our time, but we did manage to get the list, so I feel like that's a fair deal. What do you think, Steven?
Oh yeah, we did good tonight.
Yeah, we did fine. We had one audio glitch, so no big whoop. Well, I'd
like to take the time to thank you both very much for inviting me to participate tonight, John, based on one blog post and a comment. I appreciate that very much.
You've
been a
real contributor tonight. It really helped.
Absolutely. It's great having you on, Will. And Stephen, any final parting thoughts on scarcity versus abundance?
I think we got it all in.
What do you know? We're going to have a new topic for next week. So that should just about wrap it up. Michael, any shout-outs from the chat room?
All I can take from it is there's some good humor, but Clato Nicto Barada.
There's always a classical reference there.
Well, I'm not going there. All right, Stephen, what do we got music-wise going on?
All right, we got Frame by Frame is the name of the song, and the artist is called the other Chris Hardy. Apparently there's one Chris Hardy, and he's the other one.
Yeah, there's a main, a real Chris Hardy, and this would be the other one. And I'm sorry, what was the band's name again?
That's the artist's name. It's the other Chris Hardy. The song is Frame by Frame.
Gotcha, Frame by Frame by the other Chris Hardy. Okay, we've got it now, so we'll look forward to listening to that. Stephen, thanks for your contributions again to Will Brown, to Michael, to Alvis, and OK David Ray, and everyone in the chat room, and everyone listening to us live and listening to us on the podcast. Thank you for being part of Fast Forward Radio, and we look forward to being with you again very soon on the next Fast Forward Radio. Until then, live to see it.
Waiting by the phone, I spent all night just listening to the same old dial tone.